5. The raiders were driven back to the river, where our soldiers cornered them. Not many got back to Votis. But we didn't return to Venta that summer, nor the next. Incursions and alarms were constant, from Votis, from Osk, and finally from a far more powerful enemy, Kasikar. As I look back on them, those years of alarms and battles were not unhappy ones. The threat and presence of war lent tension and the gleam of excitement to ordinary matters. Perhaps men rely on war, like politics, to give them a sense of importance they lack without it. And the possibility of violence and destruction sheds a glamour on the household life which they otherwise hold in contempt. Women, I think, not needing the self-importance and not sharing the contempt, often fail to understand the virtue and necessity of warfare. But they may be caught in the glamour, and they love the beauty of courage. Yavin was now an officer in the army of Itra. His regiment, under the command of General Fora, was mostly west and south of the city, fending off incursions from Osk and Morva. Fighting was sporadic, with long quiet spells while the enemy regrouped, and during these periods, Yavin was often able to come home. For his 20th birthday, his mother gave him my sister Sallow, who was now about 16. The gift of a maiden from the mother's hands was not made lightly, but with due formality, and it was a happy occasion, for Sallow loved Yavin with all her heart, and asked only to love and serve him, and him alone. He couldn't have resisted such generous tenderness if he'd wanted to, but she was what he wanted too. Eventually, of course, he'd have to marry a woman of his own class, but that was years off and didn't matter now. He and Sallow were a blissful couple, their delight in each other so clear and lively it shed pleasure around them as a candle sheds light. When he was in the city and off duty, he spent the days with his fellow officers and other young men, but every night he came home to Sallow. When he went off to his regiment, she wept bitterly, and grieved and worried till he came riding home, tall and handsome and laughing, shouting, "Where's my Sallow?" And she came running out of the silk rooms to meet him, shy and afire with joy and pride and love, like any young soldier's bride. When I was 13, I was exiled at last from the women's rooms and sent across the court. I'd always dreaded going to the barrack, but it wasn't as bad as I'd feared, though I grievously missed the nook where Sallow and I had always slept and talked before we slept. Tib, who'd been sent across the year before, made a show of protecting me, but it wasn't needed. The big fellows didn't persecute me. They were hard on some of the young boys, but evidently I'd paid my dues that night at the well and earned their respect by my silence. They called me Marshy or Beaky, but nothing worse, and most of them simply left me alone. During the day, I saw little of any of them, since my work now was entirely in the schoolroom and library with Avera. Oko and a little boy called Papa had taken Sallow's and my place as sweepers. My task now was to get learning and to assist Avera in schooling the little ones. There was a new flock in the schoolroom, as Sotur's nieces and nephews became old enough to learn their letters, along with several new slave children we had bought or traded for. Sallow, as a gift girl, was exempt from all heavy or dirty work. She was expected only to do a modest amount of spinning or weaving, and otherwise nothing except to keep herself fresh and pretty for Yavin. She was, in fact, very bored when he was off with the army. She was used to active work, and found the company of the other gift girls and the ladies' maids tedious and stifling. She never said so, not being given to complaint, but whenever she could, she got away from the silk rooms and came back to the schoolroom to continue her reading or help Avera and me with the young pupils. And often she and I met in the library, where we could talk, just the two of us alone. She confided in me as she always had done, and relied on me, and knew I relied on her. Our companionship was the joy of my life. My sister was my other soul. Only with her was I wholly free and at peace. Only to her could I ever speak the entire truth. I have said nothing this long time about what I called remembering, those visions or waking dreams I had as a young child. They came to me still, though less often. My unbroken habit of not speaking of them to anyone but Sallow seems even now to make it hard to tell about them. At Venta, I scarcely ever had a memory of that kind. But when we came back to Archimand, every now and then, usually when I was alone reading, or near falling asleep, or waking from sleep, I would see the blue hill over the shining water and the reeds, and feel the slight, unsteady motion of the boat. Or I'd watch the snow fall on the roofs of Itra. For they could be truly memories as well as foreseeings. Or I'd be in the graveyard by the river, or in the square, watching the men fighting in the street, or in the high, dark room where the man turned his fine, sorrowful face to me and said my name. Only rarely now did I have a new vision, remembering something I had not remembered before. Several times I remembered climbing a steep hill of a city I did not know. It was raining, and the streets between high, dark houses were gloomy and strange. But there was some light shining in me, or on me, as if I bore an invisible lamp. I can't describe it better than that. Once, the winter sallow was given to Yavin, I saw a terrible figure. A naked man, as thin and black as a mummified corpse, dancing. His head was too large, with blank, bright eyes, and a red hole for a mouth. I saw him from below, as if I were lying down in some dark place. I hoped not to have that vision again. Several times I remembered being in a cave with a low stone roof, faint light falling strangely on the rocks of the cave floor. And there were brief scenes, glimpses, too quick to hold and recall clearly, though when, as sometimes happened, I met the place or person in daily life, I knew that I'd been there before or seen that face. Many people have this experience from time to time, but can't say how it is that they seem to be remembering something which is happening for the first time. For me, it was a little different, since I could remember, in the moment the event occurred, when and where I had remembered it before it occurred. After it actually happened, my memory of it was like any memory, and I could summon it at will, which I couldn't do with the visions of things that hadn't happened yet. So with the snowfall, I had my memory of the event and my memory of having seen it in a vision before it happened. And also, now and then, the vision itself, involuntary and immediate. One snowfall, three memories. Part of the pleasure I had in being with my sister was that I could tell her about these strange visions or rememberings, and talk over with her what they might be or mean, and so weaken the horror that clung to some of them. And she could tell me about doings among the family. Now that Yavin and Astano were done with their schooling, and Torm had been excused from it in order to study military arts, I saw only the young children of the family, and Sotur. She still came to study with Avera, and often to the schoolroom or the library to read. Often enough, she and Sallow and I were all together, and fell to talking as easily almost as we had used to do under the stars at the Venta farm, but never so freely. We were no longer children, and had to be conscious of our status. And I was sorely confused by my feelings for Sotur, which were a mixture of chaste adoration, which I indulged, and passionate sexual desire, which, when I recognized what it was, I feared and denied. Desire was forbidden. Chaste adoration was allowed, but I was too tongue-tied to express it, except in very bad poems, which I never showed her. In any case, Sotur didn't want either desire or adoration. She wanted our old friendship. She was lonely. Her closest friend had always been Astano, and Astano was now being groomed for courtship and marriage. There was talk, so Salo told me, of betrothing Astano to Korik Beltomo Runda, the son of the richest and most powerful senator of Itra, a man to whom our father, Altan Arka, owed a good deal of his own power and influence. Salo heard a lot of gossip of this kind in the silk rooms. She brought whatever she heard to me, and we talked it over. Korik Runda, they said, had never done any military service. His particular friends were a group of young, rich freedmen and minor nobles who led a wild life. He was said to be handsome, but inclined to fat. We wondered how our gentle, gallant Astano felt about Korik Runda, and whether she wanted to be betrothed to him, and how far the father and mother would be swayed by what she wanted. As for Sotur, their orphaned niece, her wishes in marriage wouldn't count for much. She'd be married to make the most advantageous connection. It was the lot of almost all girls of the families, not that different from the slave girls. Sometimes the thought of my grave, sweet-voiced Sotur being handed off to some uncaring man drove me to burning, helpless rage, to the point where I thought I longed for it to happen, so that she'd be gone from the house and I wouldn't have to see her daily, and be ashamed that I was only a slave and only 14 years old and only able to write my stupid poems and yearn to touch her and never be able to touch her. Salo knew how I felt, of course. If I'd wanted to hide anything from Salo, I couldn't have. She knew that I kept folded tight in a tiny pouch on a cord about my neck a note Sotur had written me a year ago when I had a fever.
"Get well soon, dear Gavir. It is as dull as dust without you."
Salo grieved for my impossible longing. She fretted over the injustice that allowed her love full satisfaction and utterly forbade it to mine, even in dream. Of course there were stories of love affairs between noble women and slaves, but they were all sad and shameful, ending in mutilation or death for the man, and for the woman, maybe not death these days, but horrible public shame and degradation. Salo tried to make sense of these hard laws, to understand them as protecting us, and she convinced both me and herself that in fact they did protect us. But she didn't try to pretend that they were just. "Justice is in the hands of the gods," an old poet wrote. "Mortal hands hold only mercy and the sword." I told her that line, and she liked it, and repeated it. I think it made her think of Yavin, her kind-hearted, beloved hero, who held both mercy and a sword. Romantic love and desire was my torment. Salo was my solace, and so was my work. Avera had finally given me free run of the library of Archimand, which till then I had never entered, even when I was a sweeper boy and went all over the house. Its door was on the corridor past the domed shrine of the ancestors. When I first entered it, I felt the fear of crossing a sacred threshold, almost as I might have done if I had transgressed and gone among the ancestors. It was a small room, well lighted by high windows of clear glass. There were over 200 books on its shelves, all carefully arranged and dusted by Avera. The room smelled of books, that subtle smell which to some is stuffy and to others intoxicating. And it was silent. No one ever came down that corridor except to sweep it or to enter the library. And no one entered the library except Avera, Sotur, Salo, and me. The girls were allowed because Sotur had asked our teacher to allow her and Salo the privilege, and Avera couldn't refuse her anything. Sotur was the only older child of the family pursuing her reading or studies, for neither Yavin nor Astano was free to do what they liked anymore. She told Avera that he had given her and Salo the soul's hunger for books and thoughts, and must not deprive them now that Sallow was starving among the inanities of the silkrooms and she among the pomposities of merchants and the illiteracy of politicians. So, with the permission of the father and mother, and with many cautions about indiscriminate reading, he gave them each a key. It was hard for me to admit it to myself, and I never talked about it with Sallow or Sotur, but the long-desired library was a disappointment. I already knew more than half the books in it, and the ones I didn't know, that looked so mysterious and treasurable sitting on the shelves in their dark leather covers or scroll boxes, mostly turned out to be dull. Annals of Law, compendia, endless epic poems by mediocre poets. They had all been there for at least 50 years, sometimes much longer. Vera was proud of the fact.
"No modern trash for Archimand," he said.
I was willing to believe him that most modern writing was trash, on the evidence that so much old writing was trash, but I didn't put it that way to him. Still, the library became dear to me as a place to be with Sallow, with Sotur, and by myself. It was a place of peace, where I could give myself to the poets I treasured, and the great historians, and my own dreams of adding something to literature. My poems to Sotur, written with my heart's blood, were stiff and stupid. I knew I was no poet, though I loved both poetry and history, the arts that brought some clarity, some hope of meaning to human emotions, and the senseless, cruel record of human wars and governments. History would be my art. I knew I had a lot to learn, but learning was a delight to me. I had grand plans of books I would write. My life's work, I decided, would be to combine the annals of the various city-states into one grand history. Thus, incidentally, I would become a grand and famous historian. I made outlines of such a synthesis, ignorant, overambitious, full of errors, but not entirely foolish. My great fear was that someone had already written my history of the city-states and that I didn't know it, because Avera wouldn't buy any new books. One morning in early spring, he sent me across town to Belmand, a household known as ours was for its books and learning. I liked going there. The teacher, Meeman, a younger man than Avera, was his closest friend. They were always exchanging books and manuscripts, often with me as messenger. I was delighted to be excused from hearing little children drone out their alphabet to get out of the house into the sunlight of morning. I took the long way round, through the sycamore grove where Torm used to drill us, south along the streets under the city walls, loitering along and enjoying my freedom all the way. At Belmand, Meeman made me welcome. He liked me, and had often talked to me about the works of some modern writers, reciting me poetry by Redeker, Caspro, and others, whose names Avera wouldn't even say. Meeman never lent me their books, knowing Avera had forbidden me to read them. This day we talked a little, but only of the rumor of war with Morva. Both Yavin and a son of the Bell family were with the army there. Meeman had to return to his schoolroom, so he gave me an armload of books, and I set off home. I went directly across town this time, because the books were heavy. I was just crossing Long Street when I heard shouting. Looking down the street towards the river gate, I saw smoke. A house afire. Or more than one house, for the clouds of smoke billowed up higher every moment. People now were rushing past me across the square behind the forefathers' shrine. Some running from the fire, some towards it. Those who ran towards it were city guards, and as they ran they drew their swords. I stood and saw, as I had seen before, a troop of soldiers coming up Long Street, mounted and afoot, under a green banner. The soldiers and the city guards met and fought with a shouting and clashing of arms. I could not move until I saw the riderless horse break from that knot and muddle of fighting men and gallop up the street straight at me, lathered with white sweat, streaked red, blood running from where its eye should be. The horse screamed, and then I could move. I dodged and ran across the square, between the shrine and the Senate House, by the back streets, to Archimand. I burst into the slave's door, shouting, "Invasion! Enemy soldiers inside the city!" It was news to the household, for Archimand is set apart by the quiet squares and broad streets of its neighborhood. There was great panic and dismay as the word spread. Elsewhere in Ytra, word of the incursion had got about much faster, and probably by the time Enumer had stopped shrieking, the city guards and off-duty soldiers and citizens had driven the invaders back out the river gate. Cavalrymen from a troop quartered near the cattle market went in pursuit of them and caught a few stragglers east of the bridge, but the main body of the enemy got away. None of our soldiers had been killed, though several had been wounded. No damage had been done except the firing of several thatch-roofed storage sheds near the gate. But the shock to the city was tremendous. How had troops from Kasikar been able to approach Ytra in broad daylight, let alone ride right in through the river gate? Was this impudent foray merely the signal of a full-scale assault from Kasikar, for which we were utterly unprepared? The incredulous shame, the rage, and the fear we all felt that first day were uncontrollable. I saw the father, Altan Arka, weep as he spoke to Torm, giving orders for the defense of the house before he left for an emergency meeting of the Senate. My heart swelled with the wish to help my family, my people, to be useful, to stand against the enemies of Ytra. I helped collect all the children in the dormitory with Iamer, and then waited in the schoolroom for orders as to what we house people could do. I wanted very much to be with Sallow, but she was shut up in the silk rooms, where male slaves could not come. Avera, gray and shaken, sat reading in silence. I paced up and down the room. There was a long, strange silence in the great house. Hours passed. Torm came by the door of the schoolroom, and seeing me, stopped.
"What are you doing here?"
"Waiting to know how we may be of use, Torm D,"
Avera said, getting up hastily. Torm shouted to someone,
"Two more here!"
then strode on without a word to Avera. Two young men came in and told us to follow them. They were wearing swords, and so must be noblemen, though we did not know them. They took us across the back court to the barrack. The barrack doors had a great outside bolt across them, which I had never seen closed before. The two young men slid it aside and ordered us in. We heard the bolt slam to behind us. All the male slaves of Archimand were there, locked up in the barrack. Even the body servants of the father, who slept in his anteroom, were there. Even the stableman and Sem, the head hostler, who lived and slept in the mews over the stables. It was terribly crowded, for with their various duties day and night, not more than half the men would normally be in the barrack, and then only to change clothes or sleep. There were not nearly enough bunks for this crowd, hardly room even to sit down. Many were afoot, talking, excited and disturbed. It was quite dark, because not only were the doors locked, but the windows had been shuttered. The close air stank of sweat and bedding. My teacher stood bewildered just inside the doors. I got him to come with me to his room, a little cubicle partitioned off from the main dormitory. There were four such cubicles reserved for the older and most highly favored slaves. Three stablemen were sitting on Avera's cot, but Sem ordered them off.
"That's the teacher's room, you stinking sons of horse dung! Get out of there!"
I thanked Sem, for Avera seemed almost stunned, unable to speak. I got him to sit down on his cot, and he was finally able to tell me that he was all right. I left him there and went to listen to what the other men were saying. When we first came in, I heard angry voices, indignant protests, but these died down as some of the older men told the younger ones that this was nothing unusual. They weren't being punished. It simply was the rule when there was threat of an attack on the city. All male slaves were locked away.
"Out of danger," said Old Fell.
"Out of danger," said a valet.
What if the enemy gets in again and sets fires? We'll roast here like pies in an oven.
Shut your fool trap, somebody told him.
Who's looking after our horses? Said a stable hand.
Why can't they trust us? What did we ever do but work for them?
Why should they trust us when they treat us like this?
I want to know who's looking after our horses.
It went on like that, on and off, all day. Some of the younger boys were my pupils. They tended to gather around me out of habit, I suppose. In the desperation of boredom, I said at last, Come on, we might as well do our lesson. Papa, start off the Bridge on the Nisus. They'd been learning that fine sing-song ballad, and they liked it. Papa, a good student, was too shy to start reciting among all these grown men. But I started off, Beneath the Walls of Ytra. Come on, Papa. He joined in, and pretty soon the boys were passing the stanzas around, one to the next, just as if we were in the schoolroom. Rally piped out bravely in his thin little voice,
Are we then men of Morva, to flee before the foe? Or shall we fight for Ytra, like our fathers long ago?
And I realized that around us the men had fallen silent and were listening. Some remembered their own schooling. Others were hearing the words, the story, for the first time. And they heard it without irony, simply stirred by the events and the call to patriotic courage. When one of the boys faltered, a couple of men picked up the verse which they'd learned long ago in a Vera schoolroom, or maybe from the teacher before him, and passed it round to the next boy. At the rousing climax, there was a cheer and congratulations to the boys, and the first laughter we'd heard all day.
Good stuff, that, said Sim. Let's have some more.
I saw Avera standing at the entrance to his cubicle, looking frail and gray, but listening. We said them another of Ferio's ballads, and they liked it well enough. Almost all of them were listening by now, but the Bridge on the Nisus remained the favorite by far.
Let's have that bridge again, some man would say, and get a boy to start off,
Beneath the Walls of Ytra. By the end of the day in the barrack, many of them had learned the whole thing, with the quickness of memory that we often lose with literacy, and could roar it out in unison. Sometimes they added verses that would have made Ferio's hair stand on end. They got scolded by other men.
Hey, keep it decent, there's kids here.
And they begged pardon of Avera, for whom most of them had an ungrudging, protective respect. The teacher was one of them, and yet not one of them. A slave of value, a learned man, who knew more than most nobles knew. They were proud of him. As order began to be established in the crowded barrack, certain men came to the fore, Sem and Metter chief among them, as keepers of order and the decision-makers. Avera was consulted, but mostly set apart and looked after. And I was fortunate in being his disciple, since I got to sleep on the floor of his cubicle, not in the terrible crowding of the main room and the stink of the walled privies behind it. The worst thing about those days, for most of us, was being kept in ignorance of what was going on. The city's fate, our fate. Food was prepared and brought to us by women slaves from the kitchen. The women were received, twice daily, when the bolt was shot back and the doors briefly opened, with roars of greeting and indecent proposals, and assailed with questions. Are we fighting? Did Kasikar attack? Are they in the city? And so on, to most of which they had no answers, though they had plenty of hearsay. Then the women were herded back to the house, and while we ate, the men would chew over those scraps and rumors, along with the bread and meat, and try to work out some sense from them. They generally agreed that there had been fighting outside the walls, probably at the river gate, and that the attackers had not broken into the city, but had not yet been driven off entirely. And when on the fourth day we were at last released, that proved to be the case. Troops in training, hastily brought up from south of the city, had joined the cavalry troop that had been nearby and beat back the attackers. The cavalry was now pursuing the Kasakarans across country. The city guard had been able to retire within the walls and man them against forays. Kasakar had brought no siege engines, counting on a surprise mass assault on the gate to get them into the city. If one of their captains, hungry for glory, hadn't led his troop to make that premature raid, we would have had little or no warning, and the city might have been taken and burnt, and we locked in the barrack. But there was no use thinking about that. We'd been released, and the joy of release was tremendous. It made up for everything. All of us who could ran out that night to cheer the first troops returning across the Nisus. My sister sneaked out of the silk rooms to meet me, and, dressed as a boy, went with me to the river gate to cheer. It was a crazy thing to do, for a gift girl who went out in the streets could be horribly punished. But there was a sense of joyous license that night, and we rode on the flood of it. We cheered the troops with all our heart and soul. Among them, in the wild torchlight, we saw Torm, marching along with his odd gait, swinging his arms, short and grim and soldierly. Sallow looked down at once to hide her face, for it wouldn't do if Torm saw his brother's gift girl out on the loose. She and I slipped back to our command after that, laughing and breathless, through the quiet dark streets and courts of our dear city. The next day we heard from Sallow, who heard it from the mother herself, that Yavin's regiment was to be brought back to guard the city. Sallow was alight with joy.
"He's coming, he's coming! I don't care what happens, so long as he's here," she said.
But that was the last good news we had for a while. Knowing Itra's armies were occupied with truce-breakers from Morva and Ask, Kasakar had sent that first wave of soldiers to make a lightning assault and take the city by surprise if they could. Repelled, they fell back at once, but only to the front lines of a whole army marching through the hills from Kasakar, the great city on the moor. Itra was now fast filling up with farmers and country people fleeing from the invaders, some in panic, empty-handed, others bringing all they could in wagons and barrows and driving their cattle before them. But on the third day after our night of rejoicing, the gates were shut. Itra was surrounded by an enemy army. From the walls, we saw them methodically setting up camp, dragging up timbers, digging earthworks as their defense against our soldiers' attack. They had come prepared for a long siege. They set up ornate tents for their officers. Their wagon trains were loaded high with grain and fodder. They made great pens for the cattle and sheep they'd taken from farms along the way and would slaughter as they needed. We saw another city growing around ours, a city of swords. We were sure at first that our armies in the south would sweep in and save us. That hope died hard. Weeks passed before we saw the first Itran troops come to harry the Kasakarans and raid their ditch and wall defenses. We cheered them from the walls and shot fire missiles into the tent city to distract the enemy, but our men always had to fall back. They were small troops, outnumbered 10 or 20 to 1. Where were the strong regiments that had gone to drive the Morvans and Oskins back to their own lands? What had happened in the south? Dire rumors ran through the city. There was no way to counter them, since we were cut off from all news. On the first morning of the siege, the Senate sent a deputation to the tower above the river gate to call out for a parley, demanding the reasons for this unprovoked and undeclared attack. The Kasakaran generals refused to make any answer, allowing their soldiers to shout and jeer at the senators. One of the senators was Altan Arka. I saw him when he came home, dark with fury and humiliation. The next day, the Senate named one of its members, Kanak Eriko Bahar, as dictator, an ancient title revived in emergencies for a temporary supreme commander. New rules and ordinances immediately began to govern our lives. strict control of food went into effect. Supplies were gathered from all households into the great market warehouses and shared out with ritual punctuality and exactness. Hoarders were hanged in the square before the Shrine of the Forefathers. All male citizens over 12 and under 80 years of age were conscripted into defense forces commanded by the city guard. As for slaves, when the siege began, many houses locked up all their male slaves again. The father of our command merely restricted us to the house and its grounds at night, keeping a strict curfew, and the same policy was soon ordered by the dictator. Obviously, male slaves were needed to do the work of the city, and were worse than useless if shut up like calves being fattened. Bahar decreed that though slaves remained their master's property, they were also at the disposal of the city of Itra during the emergency. He and the other senators could order work parties from any house to join the civic workforce in the city barrack. A slave ordered to a work party lived there for the duration of the job, under the command of the veteran General Haster. I was sent there for the first time in June, about 2 months into the siege. I was glad to go, to be of use to my city, my people. The schoolroom seemed to me shameful in its peaceable detachment from daily fears and concerns. I longed to get away from the little children and join the men. I was in high spirits, as were most of us at our command and in the city as a whole. We had survived the first shock and terror and found we could live under stern conditions, on a minimum of food, among endless alarms, trapped by an enemy bent on destroying us by sword or fire or starvation. We could not only live, we could live well, in hope and comradeship. Sallow came to see me the evening before I left for the civic barrack. She was several months pregnant, her eyes bright, her brown skin radiant, almost luminous. Though, of course, we had received no word of Yavin, she had made up her mind that if he came to any harm, she would know it. She was certain that all was well with him.
"You remember things,"
she said to me, smiling, hugging me as we sat side by side on the school bench, as we had when we were children.
"You remembered the start of this war, the first raid, didn't you? You saw it. I don't see things, but I know things, and I know them. Like Gammy always said, we marsh people, we have our powers."
She laughed and rocked me sideways, bumping me with her hip. "Oh, Sal," I said, "did you ever think you'd like to go there, to the marshes, to see where we came from?"
"No,"
she said, laughing again.
"I just want to be here, with Yavindi home and no siege and lots to eat. But you, maybe they'll let you travel. When the siege is over, when you're a scholar, they'll let you go buy books, like Meeman did. He went to Pagadi, didn't he? You can travel all over the western shore. You can go to the marshes, and everybody there will have a big nose just like yours."
She stroked my nose.
"Like storks. My beaky. You'll see."
Sotur also came by before I left. I was tongue-tied with her. She put a small leather purse in my hand.
"It might be useful. We'll be free soon, Gavir,"
she said, smiling. The freeing of the city meant freedom to all of us in our command, even if we were slaves. I found a different mood in the civic barrack. I found a very different life there. I soon understood how childishly foolish my eagerness to go there had been. Nothing in my life in our command had prepared me for the heavy work and the brutal life of a civic slave. The gang I was put in had the job of taking down an old storage building and carrying the building stones to the west gate for use in repairs to the tower and wall. The stones were massive, weighing a half ton or so. The work required skills which nobody in the group had, and tools which we had to improvise. We worked from dawn till night. We lived on the same rations we had received at our command, which were adequate for that life, not for this one. Our gang boss, Kat, was a man whose only qualifications were great strength and indifference to pain. Kat's chief, Haster's assistant for this division of the slaves, was Hobie. Hobie was the first person I saw when I came to the civic barrack. He had grown powerfully muscular. His head was shaven, which made his likeness to the father and Torm less apparent. But there was the scar that split his eyebrow, and his old truculent look. I was about to speak to him when he looked at me directly, a stare of contemptuous hatred, and turned away. He never spoke to me for the 2 months I lived in the civic barrack. It was he who put me on the rock gang, as we were called. He made my life hard in other ways, which he had the power to do. The other men saw that, and some mistreated me in order to curry favor with Hobie, while others did what they could to protect me from him. They asked me what the chief had against me, and I answered that I didn't know, except that he blamed me for his scar. Haster demanded that we bank any money we had with him, for there were men in the barrack who'd kill you for a penny if they knew you had it. I hated to part with the 10 bronze eagles in the leather purse, Sotur's gift, and the only money of my own I had ever had. Haster was honest, by his lights, keeping a fifth of whatever he held for you, but doling out the rest in small change on demand. There was a thriving black market in food, which I'd known nothing about at Archimand, and I soon learned where to go to get cracked grain or dried meat to fill my empty belly, and which extortioner gave you the best value for your pennies. My money gave out before my time was up, and the last half month on the Rock Gang was the worst. I don't remember it very clearly, partly because hunger and exhaustion put me in a condition where the visions, the rememberings, came on me more and more often, so that sometimes I went from one to another, from the place of the silky blue waters to a stinking bed where I lay gazing up at a roof of dark rock just above my face. Then I was standing at a window looking at a white mountain across a shining strait, and then all at once I was back straining to hoist or haul great stones in the summer heat. It was often the fiery sting of Kat's whip on my ribs that brought me back.
"Wake up, you staring fool!"
he'd shout, and I'd try to understand where I was and what I should be doing, while my workmates cursed me for slacking, letting them down, sometimes putting them in danger. I learned later that Kat had asked Hobie to take me off his crew weeks before. Hobie refused. At last, Kat went over his head to Haster, who said,
"He's useless. Send him home."
When I was released, it took me an hour to cross the city. I had to sit down at every corner and in every square to catch my breath and gather strength and try to push away the rememberings, the voices and strange lights and faces that filled my head. Through the branches of a forest, I saw the fountain and the broad facade of Archimand across the sunlit square. Through the darkness of a reeking cave, I crossed the square and went round to the slave's door and knocked. Enumer opened the door.
"We haven't anything to give you,"
she said sharply. I couldn't speak. She recognized me and burst into tears. I was taken to the infirmary and put to bed. Old Remen rubbed comfrey salve on my whip cuts and gave me catnip tea. My sister came to hug me, stroke my hair, croon and cry and tease me and sit beside the bed. I remembered how the mother had come when I was there before, and the memory was so clear it was like the rememberings. I spoke to her, thanking her. "I'm so glad to be home," I said.
"Of course you are. Now go to sleep," Sallow said in her husky, soft voice. "And when you wake up, you'll still be home, dear Beaky, dear Gav."
And so I slept. As soon as I recovered, and rest and food, though the food was in woefully short supply by now, were all I needed, I went back to the schoolroom and took up my duties with Avera as if I'd never been away. When in August I was called to another civic work crew, Avera was so distressed that he went to the father and protested. He came back to me and said,
"The House of Arca is blessed indeed, Gavir. It cares for its children, even in the days of war and famine." The father explained to me that you won't be under Haster's command, nor live in that barrack. The men you'll work with are all educated slaves. The task is to move the sacred prophecies and annals of the ancients from the old repository under the west wall to the vaults of the Shrine of the Forefathers, where they'll be safe from fire and water and can be hidden in case of invasion. The college priests of the shrine needs literate and intelligent slaves for the task, which must be done with due precaution and in accordance with the rituals of the ancestors. It will take care, but will not be heavy work. It is an honor to our house that you've been chosen."
He clearly took it as an honor to himself, too, and was, I think, a little envious of me, longing to see those ancient documents with his own eyes. I was glad enough to quit my schoolroom duties for a while, though apprehensive, especially about food. By now, we all thought all the time about food. Archimand had no hoarded supplies, and the city supply of everything but grain was now almost exhausted. The father and mother set an example of patient abstinence, and by rigorous supervision of the kitchens, whatever food the household got was at least shared out with justice among us all. I dreaded going back to favoritism, unfairness, and bitter rivalry over rations, the cheating and sharp dealing of the black marketeers. But I went as ordered to the slave quarters of the College of the Priests of the Forefathers' Shrine, and when the first meal I had there was a rich chicken broth with succulent barley, such as I hadn't tasted for months, I knew I was in luck. The half-dozen slaves of the shrine were all older men, so the priests had asked for assistance from houses such as Arca, Era, and Bell, where some slaves were educated. Meeman, Avera's friend from Belmand, was there, and I was very glad to see him. He had brought three younger men with him, his students. The men from Aramand, both in their 40s, were called Tadder and Ienter. I had heard Avera speak of them with grudging, suspicious admiration.
"Very learned men," he said. "Very learned, but not sound, not sound."
I knew he meant they read the moderns, books written in the last century or two. I was right. When we went to the dormitory that night, and it was crowded, with 13 men sleeping where 6 had slept, but warm, well-lighted, and as comfortable as one could hope, the first thing I saw by one bedside was a copy of the Cosmologies of Oryk Caspro. Avera had spoken of this poem once or twice the way a doctor might speak of a ghastly, deadly, infectious disease. Tadder, a dry-faced man with keen eyes under heavy black brows, saw my glance.
"Have you read it, laddie?" he asked.
He had a northern accent and some unfamiliar turns of speech. I shook my head.
"Take it, then,"
said Tadder, and he held it out to me.
"Have a look."
I didn't know what to do. I couldn't help glancing at Meeman, as if he might report me to Avera for even looking at the book.
"Avera hasn't let him read the new poets, you know," Meeman said to Tadder. "Or anybody since Trudic. Is Caspro a bit much to start with?"
"Not at all," said the northerner. "What are you, laddie, 14, 15? The very age to follow Caspro to glory. Here, do you know his song, then?"
And he sang out in a fine, pure tenor.
"As in the dark of winter night."
"Hey, hey there," said the other man from Aramand. I enter.
"Don't get us in hot water the first night, brother."
"Is that Caspro's hymn, then?"
asked the priest's senior slave, a soft-spoken old man with an unassuming air of authority.
"I have never heard it sung.
Well, there's places one gets hanged for singing it, Rabadee,
I enter said with a smile.
Not here, Raba said. Go on, please. I'd like to hear it.
Tatter and I enter exchanged glances, and then Tatter sang,
As in the dark of winter night, the eyes seek dawn. As in the bonds of bitter cold, the heart craves sun. So blinded and so bound, the soul cries out to thee. Be our light, our fire, our life, liberty.
The beauty of his voice and the sweet sudden leap of the tune on that last word brought tears into my eyes. I enter saw it and said,
Ah, look what you've done to the boy, Tatter. Corrupted him with a single verse.
Meeman laughed. The Vera will never forgive me, he said. Sing it again, Tatterdee, one of Meeman's students asked, with a glance at Reba for permission. Reba nodded, and this time several voices joined in the singing. And I realized then that I'd heard the tune, fragments of it, in the civic barrack now and then, whistled, a few notes, like a signal.
Enough, the senior slave said in his quiet voice. We don't want to wake our masters.
Oh, no, surely not, said Tatter. We don't want to do that.